You're listening to Bob, Dave, and Moore.
Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
The 5 o'clock refresh is brought to you by Frost Brewed Coors Light, made to chill. We always love catching up with this guy, never short of an opinion, and he knows a thing or two about playing in the NFL. He is our buddy Mark Schlereth. Mark, how are you, man?
Hey, how are you guys doing? Always great to catch up.
We're doing great. We appreciate your time as always. And I want to play a clip for listeners that didn't hear what you had to say. You got, you know, we always hear about skill positions. We hear about, you know, the wide receivers and the cornerbacks and the running backs, quarterbacks, this, you know, those guys with a skill. And you expressed the thought on that that I don't know many have heard. Here's what you had to say.
Hey, guys, your boy Stinkin'. I'll admit I'm a bit triggered right now. I am so sick and tired after this last draft of hearing all these experts, these fantasy football experts, tell me about the importance of the skill position players and having speed at the skill position players. Let me tell you what the greatest skill in sports is, right? Taking a man who's the same size, weight, and strength as you and moving him from point A to point B against his will. That's a skill. Man, that's the toughest skill in all of sports. And think about this now. Positional transition, right? You've all seen it happen before. You've seen a cornerback go from corner to safety, and you've seen a safety transition from safety to linebacker. You've seen a linebacker who's a stand-up player transition, put his hand in the dirt, and become a rush defensive end. You've seen a defensive end put on weight and transition to defensive tackle. You've even seen a defensive tackle transition to the offensive side of the ball and play offensive line. You know what the transition for an offensive lineman is? It goes O-line, fan. That's the transition.
Oh, that was well done, Mark. Well done.
Am I right? We are the last rung on the athletic ladder. I mean, there ain't nowhere else to go. It's officer and a gentleman when you play offensive line. There ain't nowhere else to go on the field.
Oh, did that bother you when you were playing to hear those positions referred to as skill positions, or is this more of a new phenomenon for you?
It's always bothered me because, like, I used to say it all the time. I was like, shoot, you know, when I could go into the Fox cafeteria and throw a football. Anybody could catch it and throw it back to me. If I set a one-on-one drill up in the Fox cafeteria, I'd whip some ass in there. Because I just know what I'm doing, right? I mean, that's the thing that I always looked at is that's a skill. That's a skill that has to be honed. And as I travel around the NFL calling games, I'm telling you what, I talk to general managers and coaches all the time that all ask me, like, how would you do it? How would you teach in today's NFL where we don't get practice time, we don't get to put on the pads, how would you do it? I've been asked this offseason. Now, obviously, COVID-19 has put a damper on that, but I've been asked by four different NFL teams to consult based on offensive line play. So, you know, it's such a nuanced position, and, you know, we get so enamored. I think fantasy football has ruined this for a lot of people, but we get so enamored with a guy that runs a fast 40. You know, and I'll never forget, I was talking to a buddy of mine who coaches in Cincinnati or used to coach in Cincinnati, talking about John Ross, who ran the fastest 40 time in the history of the combine. That's got combined about six catches in 3 years. They said the first mini camp, one of those DBs that was a really first round draft choice, really good DB, like jammed his hand in his chest, broke his sternum, and ripped out his heart. And the kid was done for 3 months. You know, I mean that. Like, it's a different game. I don't care how fast you are. You got to be a damn football player. And so, you know, we get all excited about, you know, getting guys that can run fast. I want football players. I don't care about guys that can run fast.
All right, Mark. So let me ask you, when you settled at that point, at the bottom of the rung, as you like to call it, because I was a running back in grade school in flag football, and then I was a tight end in high school, and I kind of settled at linebacker when I went to college and in the pros. At what point did you go, okay, I'm an offensive lineman?
I got recruited as a tight end and a linebacker to University of Hawaii. I went to Idaho. I was an offensive lineman. I redshirted. Then I moved over to defense. I played nose guard. I played defensive end. I played a lot of different positions. I kept getting hurt. And it was that last injury where I realized, you know what, I'm earthbound. Like I just where I have to be. Now, Dave, here's the funny thing. So my first year in the league during my rookie year, during preseason, I covered kickoffs. I was R1 because I was 285 and ran in the 4.7s. And so I could run. And what's funny is, you know, as you get older, you don't care about stuff like that. And I always remember we threw a pick. It was like my second year in the league. This one I thought I was a real athlete, right? And I could still run. We threw a pick. I think it was against the Niners. And I spin around and I'm gonna hunt down, like I'm gonna run down. It was a defensive lineman that picked it off. And he takes off, so I spin around. And within three steps, I know I'm gonna catch him, right? And I gotta catch him. It's probably like a 50-yard interception return for a touchdown, you know, and I'm gonna catch him somewhere around the 15 or 20, you know. So I'm hunting him up, right? This DB ran by me and went and turned around and started backpedaling in front of me just to hinder my progress towards the tackle. And that's when I realized, I'm like, yeah, I'm a little out of my league nowadays. You know, I mean, it got to the point where I was like, yeah, okay, you are an offensive lineman. Just stop. And from that point forward, anytime there was an interception, I learned this valuable technique. So here's my technique. I'd take off sprinting like I wanted to make a tackle. And I would start leaning like I had one really short leg. You ever see the guy with a shoe, you know, that's got a big lift on it? You know, he's got one short leg. And I would start running like that and run myself off the film. And then I would just stop giving effort because then I would know, like, eventually, like it looked like I was really hustling at first. And then I know kind of how the camera's following the play. And then I would just run off the field and just walk to the sideline because if I have to run 40 yards, somebody's going to score. Like, I'm not catching anybody. So, yeah, that's pretty much when I learned that I was no longer an athlete.
Hey, Mark, you mentioned playing college football at Idaho, and I can still remember going to school at Washington State where we'd go over to the golf course there, the Moscow golf course, and we'd turn to the side and smack some balls off the Kibbe Dome on occasion. What was it like for you playing there at Idaho? And you also had Dennis Erickson as a coach and Keith Gilbertson, too.
It was great. You know, it was some of my greatest friends in the world are the guys that I played college football with. It was an incredible atmosphere. It was just, you know, we didn't have the greatest athletes in the world, but one of the things I learned about football in general is you don't have to have the best athletes in the world. If you got guys that are tough and you got guys that are smart and understand the game, you can win a lot of football games. And one thing about Idaho is we didn't have the greatest talent in the world, obviously. But we had a lot of really good football players, just a lot of guys who cared, a lot of guys who were committed, a lot of guys who sacrificed for one another. And so, you know, I was blessed to be on world championship teams, but I learned a lot about what it took to be a champion by playing at Idaho and by the sacrifice that you have to make and the commitment you have to your teammates to be good.
Hey, Mark, we've had a lot of discussion about this Seahawks defense and what the problems were last year. I mean, overall, not a good defense by any stretch of the imagination. Didn't really do much of anything really well. And the debate became, well, they were always in this base defense. They had three linebackers. They had Michael Kendricks out there trying to cover people, and what a mistake. Well, their nickel defense was arguably worse. They just didn't have a nickel corner that really could do anything. Jamar Taylor, Akeem King, it was just sort of bad either way. And I know you've got some thoughts on base defense and what it does to the in terms of the ability to generate a pass rush. Give us your thoughts on that.
When you go back, and I went back and looked at about four games before I came on here, just to kind of see what they were. They're a 50 front, meaning an over front. So they're a four down 50 front, meaning they're gonna have a reduction over a guard on the strong side of the formation, because they want to keep KJ Wright off the ball. They want him to be an off the ball linebacker. So they'll get into those 50 fronts and they'll play a lot of like a 57 front, a Will on the ball with the linebacker off the ball. So that does two things for you. That's the majority of what they're in up front. Well, the two things that does is that puts your defensive end on the side of that Sam linebacker, which is KJ Wright. That puts him head up over the tight end, which is a it's not an advantageous place to rush the passer because you got to get through the tight end. You're going to be encumbered there, and then the tackle is going to get to you. And on the opposite side, when KJ Wright's on the ball, and they like to have him on the ball a bunch in their base stuff, even when they match up base to nickel, that puts that defensive end, if that's Jadeveon Clowney or whoever, that puts him head up over the offensive tackle in a four technique or maybe a little bit outside shade in a five or in a four eye where he's a predetermined pinch. And so they're not great places to rush the passer from anytime you get into that defense. And, you know, I went through a bunch of them, a bunch of games, and, you know, a quarter of this game, a quarter of that game, a quarter of that. That's the base front that they want to be in the majority of the time that they play. And you know, one of the things teams do is teams will get, like, if Jadeveon Clowney is lining up on the as a right defensive end, they'll put tight ends, they'll become a left-handed football team. So they'll bring tight ends over there and say, okay, now you're going to have to rush through the tight end. You know, they can match up that way. So from a pass rushing standpoint, it's really hard to get your guys in great position to rush the passer out of that base defense when you're playing, you know, that over front.
Let me ask you this, Mark. Did you see when you looked at your...
I'm sorry. That was like you and I are probably the only two people in Seattle who are like, yeah, that makes sense, right? Everybody else is like, losing what's the son of Francis? Yeah. Sorry, guys. That was real football nerd there. So just know that it's not a great place to rush the passer from on the defensive end position.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think I see what you're talking about. I would just say, though, that... A couple of things with the lack of pass rush for the Seahawks. They had 28, so they were second to last. Only the Dolphins had less. But, man, I don't know how many times you saw this, but when I went back through the games, the ball was coming out so fast. The best pass rushing team in the league's not going to get home because, you know, it just they just played a really – I mean, they played together. And I'll say this. Look, they played defense well enough to win 12 games. Right? I mean, I feel like they did not want to get beat over the top. That was the number one priority. If you were going to go down the field, and this is a team that did take the ball away. I think they were third in the NFL as far as takeaways go. That, you know, they played very safe. There wasn't a lot of aggressive coverage. So, you know, for that reason, there was a lot of times where there just wasn't really time to get to the quarterback. I thought that owed, and I don't remember them seeing it that way in the past. Certainly not, you know, in the Legion of Boom era where they would just man up guys and play press up on the line and, you know, the ball was, gonna sometimes come out a lot later because everybody was covered.
I think one of the other things, you know, and I agree with you, like you look at like when you had the Legion of Boom, and I think, you know, you look at the position of safety in this league, and, you know, it's funny how from a positional standpoint, we like they evolve and the importance of guys just becomes greater. The guy in the middle of the field that can just read and erase plays has become so, because it's so, you know, between the 20s, it's so 8-man front, safety drop down, you know, playing a lot of zone stuff, 4 across, but that is a very prevalent factor. And if you don't have somebody in the middle of the field that can erase things, it's really hard to play some of that stuff. So I'm with you. From the aggressive standpoint, you want to put a lot of pressure on quarterbacks. You got to be able, you know, you got to be able to obviously to rush them, to make them hold the ball. And to do that, you've got to disrupt the routes and you got to hold guys up. And I will say this though, the linebackers that they have, I'm a huge fan of KJ Wright and Kendricks and obviously Bobby Wagner. They are phenomenal, and I understand why. You know, they feel like, hey, man, we want to play base to nickel because our three guys are really damn good. And so, you know, I get that part of it. And I'm with you. You won 12 games. That's a pretty tough task, especially in the NFC West, where you had San Francisco playing the way they played and obviously the Rams and what they've done the last couple of years. And Arizona actually came on and played pretty well towards the end of the season, too. So I understand we want to be perfect at everything. It's hard to be.
Yeah, let me ask you this, Mark. We've just been getting a little bit of some stuff up here from Colin Coward, who I respect. I think he's done a really good job. But I want to play you cut number six, because all of a sudden it sounds like Colin Coward feels like we're not using Russell Wilson here the right way.
Pete Carroll's never been known as having kind of what you would call like Kyle Shanahan offense or Andy Reid creative play designing. That's not Pete's thing, right? He hands the offense over. So I think Russell has largely outperformed the schemes. And he's got 100 touchdowns in the last 3 years. That's touchdown passes. That's 15 more than the next closest quarterback, Tom Brady.
He seems to contradict himself, Mark.
Well, like, Colin will do that occasionally. Listen, here's what I love about Russell Wilson. Russell Wilson doesn't care how you win as long as you get a chance to win. And he's one of the purest, as you guys know, deep ball passers that we've seen in this league. And he creates off that deep ball. But having conversations over the last couple of years with Pete Carroll, and I love it. Yeah, Pete Carroll was like, we had this conversation last year about the transition back to kind of pure 90s football, where we're going to run, we're going to get multiple tight ends, we're going to get you with personnel groupings, right? We're going to jump in and out of, you know, 21 and 22 and 12 and then 11, and then we're going to get you with personnel groupings, we're going to get you with those matchups, but essentially we're going to bludgeon you. And then, you know, we're going to condense to throw, you know, to throw deep. We're going to spread to run the ball. Like, it's getting back to some of that. And you look at, like, look at the playoff teams. And I know sometimes these numbers get skewed. I'm not a big numbers guy. But I think 7 of the top 10 rushing teams in football went to the playoffs. 3 of the top 10 passing teams went to the playoffs. And I know if you get behind, yeah, you have to throw it a lot. But there's something about controlling the line of scrimmage. There's something about playing that style of football that lends itself to, at the end of the year, being a playoff team and having a chance to win a world championship.
Hey, Mark, we're looking at a situation here in Seattle where there might be 4 new starting offensive linemen. And just wondering from your perspective how difficult that's going to be, especially in a year where you're not maybe going to get too much practice.
I mean, it's already hard enough because, you know, obviously of what's going on and OTAs and the communication factor and all that stuff. And then you eliminate your ability to put on pads and actually get a feel, you know, for what you're doing and working together. And that becomes it becomes a really tough task. And so nuance becomes very important. Understanding of, you know, of what a defense is doing, the shades, what we're trying to accomplish, having the rules down and all those things. It's a very tough task. It's just getting tougher and tougher all the time. And so, yeah, that's going to be something that's, you know, that's tough. But like I said, it's much easier to be committed to running the ball. And that takes a lot of pressure off of you, because, you know, ultimately, I always think about pass protection this way. Like, people want to bag on offensive lines that can't protect the quarterback. And I really look at a large portion of protecting the quarterback is your play caller's responsibility. So, for instance, if we throw it 30 times, right, how many legitimate opportunities to rush the passer am I going to give you? So if I can go, all right, we're going to throw it 30 times, but we're going to throw, you know, 5 bubble screens, right, or swing passes. We're going to have 5 three-step drops. So now all of a sudden I've already eliminated 10 pass protections. So now I'm down to 20. Now I'm down to legitimate 20. Now how many can I get 5 five-step drops in that have no hitch to them? So some type of all-go, you know, some type of five-step drop where I can actually say, hey, man, if I want to upkick this and I want to take the battle to you up front, I can do that. Now we're down to 15 throws, right? Now if we stick a 7-step drop in there, but we run it off a play action, off a play we've run 4 times, right, you have to respect that as a defense. And so now, even though it's a 7-step drop, I do that 5 times. Now I'm down to 10 times, whereas an offensive line, I have to actually legitimately pass protect. Like, I should be able to win that. But that comes down to coaching, guys. And unfortunately, there's too many coaches that just think you can drop back 40 times a game and be successful. Pete Carroll knows better than that. He understands that. Brian Schottenheimer, he knows better than that. So some of the things you do as an offense is really to mitigate, you know, being in situations that are going to get your quarterback killed. And those things are important, and that comes down to really good coaching. And the good coaches understand it, and the bad coaches, you know, those guys are the ones that get fired looking for work and get quarterbacks hurt.
Yeah, Mark, you being an offensive lineman, I'm just curious about pass blocking versus run blocking, because every year I go into it thinking, all right, they're a run-first offense, they need good run blockers, and yet at the same time, as Russell Wilson gets older, he's 31 now, we know that he hasn't missed a game yet, but he gets sacked 50 times a season, so what's the balance there? I imagine it's a tough dilemma when you're drafting guys or getting them in free agency.
You're getting, you know, when you're getting guys that are defensive players and you're trying to transition them over. So, I mean, there is pass protection is just hard, right? And so, you know, think about, here's the thing about pass protection is I line up against you for 65 plays in a row, right? I whip your butt for 64 plays in a row. I give up one sack at the end of a game in a critical situation. You go to the Pro Bowl. And I'm some guy who sucks who gave up a sack in a critical situation, right? That's what pass protection is. It is exceptionally hard. And every time I line up, think about this is the only position in sports, guy. And this is why it's such a skilled position and such a technical position. Is every time I line up, the guy that's across from me is a better athlete than me. I mean, exponentially better athlete than I am. And so if my technique and my understanding of the game isn't at the highest level, then I don't have a chance. And so there's a lot that goes into protecting the passer. And, you know, some of those things when you see, hey, Russell Wilson got sacked 50 times. Well, sometimes it's, hey, Russell Wilson holds on the ball because he wants something big to develop over the top. And he and, you know, and Lockett I've got this mind melt going on, and they see something, and so they're extending it and breaking a route off in the middle and going deep, and, you know, and he's holding on to the football, and you've got a clock in your head that says, man, if we get this call, like I knew every drop of our offense, every drop in the timing of every route based on the route combination that was called. So, you know, if I'm getting, you know, a shallow cross, you know, I know the timing of that, but I know that that's a 5-step drop, and I know the timing of that play and what's, you know, what is supposed to happen. If I'm getting drag and pump with a buffalo on the backside, I know the timing of that route combination, and I know that's a 5-step drop, but I know you're trying to hit that through route by the tight end. You know, I know those things, and so I know that timing. And if you hold the ball, well, shoot, that's on you. Like, if you hold the ball because you see something and you guys are on this mind melt, well, a lot of that stuff goes on the quarterback. So, you know, we'll look at an offensive line that gives up 3 or 4 sacks, and we'll go, boy, they really suck today. And sometimes 3 of the 4 are your quarterback's fault.
Mark, always fun to talk to you, man. We really appreciate you cutting out time for us. Take care. Stay safe out there, and we look forward to talking to you soon.
I'm guys. You guys have a great one. Always fun talking to you.
There you go. Mark Schlereth spending some time with us. A reminder, high school athletes in our region and across the nation had their sports seasons or even careers cut short by the COVID-19 pandemic, and 710 ESPN Seattle wants to recognize them. So if you know of a local team or athlete impacted by the crisis, then use the hashtag 710 Hometown Heroes. Again, hashtag 710 Hometown Heroes. Use that on Twitter or Facebook to share their story and why they are your hometown hero. Coming up, who's the best deep ball thrower in the NFL? NFL.com put together a list. You might be surprised who they say is number one. We'll tell you about that next with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio. Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Coming up in less than 15 minutes, Tom Glavine had some thoughts on what today's current crop of baseball players should do when addressing the negotiations between them and Major League Baseball to get the season going. So we'll get to that coming up in the next segment. But NFL.com put together a list of best deep ball throwers in the league right now. And number one on that list, surprised me, is they have Dak Prescott is their number one. So they define a deep ball as any ball traveling 20 air yards. So it's got to go through the air at least 20 yards. And on those passes, his completion percentage was 44.4. They have an expected completion percentage based on, you know, the amount of gap there is and how tough the pass is and all that good stuff, but of 31%. So the difference was plus 13.4%. And he's 6 touchdowns to 2 interceptions when throwing the deep ball, a passer rating of 109.7. Number two on that list, Russell Wilson. His completion percentage is 42.7 with an expected completion percentage of 29.9. So much more difficult passes. His difference is plus 12.8. His TD to interception ratio on the deep ball, 11-2. And his passer rating is 119.2. And then they put it, and then he does a little description, or they do a little description for each one. And they said the mind-blowing stat that might have been better to lead with, but close, Wilson averaged a minuscule 1.5 yards of target separation on deep passes in 2019. That's the lowest in the NFL. Seahawks receivers recorded 32 deep receptions in 2019. That's the most in the NFL. Russell led all of these quarterbacks in what they call dimes. That's 30-plus air yards with a tight window resulting in a completion. He had 9 completions like that. They said doing the most with the least per usual.
How well, about that? The 1.5 yards of target separation, huh? That's what they
were.
Wow.
That was lowest in the NFL.
Yeah, that looks like it's really hard to judge and measure. But he does. He throws a great deep ball. And the thing is about his, and I guess I haven't paid that much attention to Dak Prescott, but Russ has come out of, do you remember when Richard Sherman used to say that it looked like a jugs machine? Because, you know, he would look back, you know, he'd be covering the receiver in practice, and he'd look back at the scrum, that's the line of scrimmage, and the blocking and everything, and all of a sudden this ball would just come shooting out of there. And then the other thing about it is it drops straight down almost. So it that way, you know, the defender's hand, it's a lot harder to get, you know, to get their hands on it. So, yeah, I would have said he was the best, but I think Jared Goff is good. Do you know where Jared Goff was on that list? Just from watching him?
I'm looking. It's just the top 10. I'll give you the rest of the top 10 before Jim jumps in. So number one is Dak Prescott, according to this. Number two is Russell Wilson. Number three is Patrick Mahomes. Number four is Tom Brady, that old washed-up quarterback Tom Brady. He's number four. Kyler Murray was number five. Deshaun Watson was six. Kirk Cousins, number seven. Ryan Fitzpatrick was number eight. Matt Ryan, number nine. And number 10, I don't even believe it, Baker Mayfield.
Me neither. Yeah, that's...
That puts the credibility of this list into question.
Well, you know what I'd like to see? I suppose if you're a Cowboys fan, you can sit there and go, well, yeah, Dak is really good at the long ball, but we know about Russell Wilson, how those moonshots, and boy, I remember that one against Kansas City a couple of years ago where he just found Lockett along the right sideline, just, you know, came out of like the 300 level there at CenturyLink, and it just seems like case closed to me when you talk, Bob, about the 1.5 yards of separation and NFL low. And then 32 deep catches, the most in the NFL. So you got the least amount of separation, and yet you've got the highest number of catches. Case closed, Russell Wilson should be number one over Dak Prescott. And I imagine Colin Cowherd will make his whole show out of that, all 3 hours of it tomorrow. I don't quite get that one.
How does he turn that into the Seahawks don't really respect him?
I don't know. I don't know. He'll figure out a way. You know, the other thing that occurred to me is I'm just sitting here. Who in the world does this stuff? Who tracks this stuff?
Yeah.
But good for them for doing it.
Well, and Russell leading, you know, with air yards of 30 or more, he leads the NFL in that, so throwing even deeper. So really, really, to me, it says he's number one. He's got a higher passer rating and a better touchdown interception ratio than Dak does. So, you know, with all due respect to Dak, I think you're right. I think Russell Wilson's the best deep ball thrower in the league.
Yeah, this is a kind of an interesting conversation that we've been having about Russell, because I find myself, like, you know, just like texters or when we're talking about this, like, we've always felt like Russell has been underappreciated. But it's more of the recognition that he's gotten. Now it is turned towards that the team is disrespecting him, and they're not giving him what he needs. But again, I'd still go back to, the fact that he is, you know, this is a run first offense, and it's worked for him. And if you look at the number of, like, him throwing more, and I know, and it, just like Mark said, I know when you're behind, yeah, you're definitely throwing a lot more to get back in the game. So that does skew it a little bit, but just for Russell, it has been, you know, now maybe he develops into this guy that, you know, is going to throw 35 to 40, 45 times a game, but so far it has not been the way that it's worked here. I mean, they've had winning success playing it the way that they have. And again, going back to 2017, that wasn't a very good year. Russ had to do everything that year. So, I mean, that's kind of what I look at. But I remember talking, Jimmy, for the story a million times, where it was like 2013 or 14, I asked Pete, do you think with Russell that, you know, eventually the pass attempts would start to go up naturally because he's proven to be so good? And he said that notion was offensive to him because yeah, he just thought it was working. And so I don't know, but, you know, if you take Russ and put him into a situation where he's going to have to throw the ball all the time, you know, so far anyway, at least, it just hasn't really produced. I think that there's like a perfect blend, but just throwing it all the time. And then some people will say, well, they're just not creative enough. Well, it's not that easy, man, in the NFL. And there's a few teams that do it. I mean, there's not very many Andy Reid, Patrick Mahomes combinations, you know? And then, you know, the thing with Brady, it's not like he's so athletic and everything. It's just that he sees the field so well that he can tell you what everybody did. I mean, those guys are few and far between. And I think Russell has gotten better and better at that every year. And so, you know, but I mean, I don't know that if you put him into some kind of a scheme where he's going to be throwing it, you know, that many times a game, that he's necessarily going to have more success. I think it's worked out really well for him. I think early on, because of the play action pass, that's really difficult. You know, maybe they should increase their RPOs, whatever. He's really good at handling the ball. But, you know, again, I just go back to, if it's not broke, don't fix it, because the way that they've been winning and the way it's all been worked out, this is just kind of bizarre that all of a sudden this is just coming out of seemingly nowhere, that that the Seahawks are misusing Russell Wilson when these people that are saying it never gave him respect in the first place. You know, it was like, where have you been all of these years? And now you want to come in and try to ruin it by saying, well, he needs to throw more, the cooking people, as Jim said. You know, that he needs to throw the ball more. And that's not necessarily what has worked around here. So it's confusing.
All right. Good stuff there. Coming up, if there is no baseball season this year, who do you blame? Former Braves pitcher Tom Glavine says the players are going to look like the villains. We'll talk about it next with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and Moore.
Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
You know, we've talked about baseball coming back and the proposals out there from the league and the owners, and players seem to be in agreement on just about everything, I think, at this point, except for the compensation. That seems to be the sticking point, and nobody's going to look good, in my opinion. I think the owners and the players are going to look bad if there's no season because they couldn't come to a financial agreement. Tom Glavine was speaking with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. and said that Major League Baseball players will look bad if there's no season. His quote is, if it were to come down to an economic issue, that's the reason baseball doesn't come back. You're looking at a situation similar to the strike of 94 and 95 as far as the fans are concerned. He says, even if players were 100% justified in what they're complaining about, they're still going to look bad. I don't disagree with him. I think people are going to look at this and say, wait a minute, you've got Blake Snell out there saying, I should be getting seven. I need mine. I can't live with $3.5 million. When you've got a majority of this country, or not a majority, but a large chunk of this country, wondering when their next unemployment check is going to come, and is it going to be able to cover their rent and cover their food? And you got this guy going, no. And cut number nine, for those that didn't hear Blake Snell, here's what he had to say about taking a pay cut.
Y'all got to understand, too, because y'all going to be like, bro, Blake, play for the love of the game, man. What's wrong with you, bro? Money should not be a thing. Bro, I'm risking my life. What do you mean it should not be a thing? It 100% should be a thing. If I'm going to play, I should be getting the money I signed to be getting paid. I should not be getting half of what I'm getting paid because the season's cut in half on top of a 33% cut of the half that's already there. So I'm really getting like 25%. On top of that, it's getting taxed. So imagine how much I'm actually making to play. You know what I'm saying? And on top of that, so all that money's gone. And now I play risking my life.
So I don't think that played very well. And then cut number 10, Carlos Correa says, if Major League Baseball plays half the games, then half the pay sounds right to him.
So if we get back July 1st, that means we play July, August, September, October. We play 4 months. So I don't know. I gotta see the numbers. I gotta check. But we definitely want to play. If we don't play, we don't get paid. If we don't play, MLB don't make any money. So we gotta reach an agreement where we both are happy and we agree to. But I think if we only play half the season, 15% of our pay, I'll play for the time that we play. Obviously, we're our contract's for 162 games. So if we play 81, then getting paid half of it sounds right.
So he wants the prorated amount, and we've heard about the economics of that. I get that the players have an agreement, and I get that they're worried that baseball is going to use this against them moving forward. It's going to institute a salary cap, all of that. I think if you can get it in writing from the owners that, hey, this is, we're talking about a really unique, special circumstance here. We're talking about this season. This is what we're doing this season. This doesn't translate to any other season. It's back to business as usual, hopefully next year. But this year, you've got to take into consideration what's going on in this country, what people are dealing with. And to me, you bite the bullet. It's easy for me to say, not my money, but I think Glavin's right. The players are going to look really bad.
Yeah, a wise man said, this is a time for bridges, not bunkers. And, you know, that to me is, it's a special situation. And so I think for that reason, it is going to make the players look really bad. And so, yeah, and Blake Snell from, what is he, from Shoreline? I'm not sure what that accent
was.
Yeah,
it doesn't sound like it.
Yeah, but, yeah, that was a bad look for him. And then, you know, everybody pays taxes. So those are the kinds of things that, you know, people are pretty sensitive right now. And I've kind of made fun of that a little bit. But also, you know, you kind of have to take heed to the fact that people are sensitive right now. So to me, yeah, that's, I just think it's a no-win situation for the players. And yeah, it's interesting. It came from Carlos Correa. Are we willing to listen to him, Bob? Because he's one of those guys that was complicit.
He is complicit.
And I'm just teasing you because you say that, and I agree with you. But yeah, I mean, he's with the Houston Astros, and you know, he seems to be the one guy who, and I'm not sure how it sort of splits as far as players go. Have we seen any kind of poll or anything, or how the majority of players feel? Because again, I feel like everybody can relate to the guy that shows up to work and gets paid for going to work. And if somebody doesn't go to work, you know, why would they get paid anything? So, yeah, I think it makes more sense that way.
Well, yeah, and Bob, you said it. This is what we're doing this season. It's not going to apply to next season or the next season after that. This is what we're doing this season. Special circumstances, Dave, you talk. I mean, we all know how special the circumstances are, not in the good way being special, but if you're losing 40% of your revenues by not having fans attend games, I don't see, I mean, I'm just sitting there going, I was even thinking about my own situation here at the radio station, and if we're losing a lot of money and the employer comes to you and says, hey, we got to have you take a 10 or 20% pay cut, I really don't think I'd sit here and go, nah, man, you got to pay me full freight. I just don't get that. I like to think that I'd say, okay, I understand. I'll do whatever it takes. And especially a guy like Blake Snell, there's a lot of Blake Snells too. I mean, this guy, let's say he makes peanuts this year. Let's say he doesn't make anything. He's still scheduled to make $11 million next year, $13 million in 2022, and $16.6 million in 2023. So, yeah, I just don't get it. I think Tom Glavine's right. The players are going to come off bad. I know El Hombre thinks the owners, you know, that you shouldn't be on the owner's side, but I am on this one. I don't see how you can be on the player's side when the owners are losing revenues, not having fans at the games.
Yeah, it's something that I think they need to put that in writing, right? Just isolate this year and say these are special circumstances. It is not expected that any of this carries over into a regular season. This is not a gateway to a salary cap. I want full freight next year for a full season. Nothing changes. It's this year. This is unlike anything this country has ever seen. We know how important sports are to the country. Yeah, maybe you're scheduled to make seven. You're going to get three this year. Hopefully you can get by on that. I just think it doesn't play well. When people are truly struggling and you hear a guy saying, no, I got to get mine, and as Jim pointed out, yeah, risking your life, but you're not risking it more than the Costco worker, more than the grocery store, more than the delivery guy. You're getting tested more than anybody possibly could. You're isolated more than anybody possibly could be. You're being taken care of in a way that 99% of the people in this country are not being taken care of. So, yeah, is there a risk? Certainly. More of a risk than the general public? Absolutely not.
Yeah, all of those are great points, Bob. And, you know, and the thing is, really, he's much more at risk of having Tommy John surgery. You know, as far as, you know, the group that he's in, you mentioned the testing and the care that they're taking and everything. So, yeah, it's just, I don't know, I guess the word I would use is it sounds kind of opportunistic. And anybody that's trying to kind of cash in on this is not going to be seen in a good light, no matter what, whether it's right or wrong.
All right, coming up next, one of my all-time favorite segments on this show. It is What We Learned, and it's coming up next with Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Wow, you sure know a lot of stuff.
It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
The learning never stops here with Bob, Dave, and Moore, and today is no exception. So what did we learn today, DJ?
Well, first we learned the one thing that is certain about the Quentin Dunbar case.
Yeah, I enjoyed that little blurb on Baker, Jim, and it just, listen, everybody there is full of it, okay? Everybody involved with the situation is absolutely full of it. That includes the attorneys. That includes the so-called witnesses. That includes Baker, Dunbar. Everybody associated with this thing is absolutely full of it. That's what I'm certain of. I don't know what the truth is. I think everybody's lying. How about that? So moving on from that, so stupid. He was playing Madden.
Yeah, that's on the heels of the attorney for DeAndre Baker saying, yeah, he couldn't have done it. He was in another room playing Madden. Like, okay, what? It gets more and more absurd. I don't even expect this to go to court. I think it gets all dropped, and it's just going to be sorted out in the streets, perhaps. Who knows where it gets sorted out? But, yeah, there's no doubt everybody in there is lying.
You know, Dunbar's attorney, Grieco, said that there was no video anywhere. Don't you wish there was a video camera somewhere that captured the whole thing?
I can't believe there's not. Everybody's got a phone. Everything gets recorded.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you're running for your life, if there are guns out, you're not thinking, gee, I need to capture this on my phone, are you?
I don't know if everybody's holding still, sitting, or if they're trying to run. We don't know, Jim. I don't know if they're on the floor, hands up in the air. Who knows what's going on? But
well, the funniest thing to me, it's all lies.
The
funniest thing to me is Grieco, the attorney for Dunbar, saying that all these victims are scam artists. So
yeah,
how do you make heads or tails out of that? Which story are they telling is true? I mean, did they make the first story up or the second?
I guess it doesn't matter if they're scam artists and they can't be trusted, then neither of their testimonies, the one for Dunbar or the one against Dunbar, can be trusted, so it probably just gets thrown out. What else did we learn, DJ?
We learned that too many hot takes from Colin Cowherd really makes the professor want to vomit.
Hey, let me... I actually want to play one more for you from Colin. It's more about the offense and what Russell's been able
to do. Hold on, I got
to
get my barf bag out, so can I do that?
Yeah, get it ready, John. Get it ready. I want you to strap yourself into that chair. Get the bag ready.
I haven't heard that word barf in a while.
That's a good one. Yeah, very good from the professor.
I'm gonna throw up. I'm going to vomit. I'm going to yak. I haven't heard barf in a long time. That feels like an old word.
I haven't heard yak in a while, Bob.
You haven't?
Oh, yeah.
It's a goodie.
No.
What are some of the other ones? Isn't there one called,
Hurl.
Isn't it Technicolor, Yawn?
Hurl.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Hurl's a good one.
That's a good one.
I'm going to heave.
Yeah.
Heave. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dry heaves.
Those are no fun.
That's the worst.
Nobody wins with a dry heave. It's no good.
Has anybody ever thrown up on an airplane and used a barf bag?
No.
No.
Yes.
I never have.
Motion sickness, Dave.
Oh, Jim, that's right. I forgot about that. You and Norwood.
Oh, man. There was one time I was in Atlanta, and we finally landed, and I went straight back to the bathroom, and finally the flight attendant, I was the last one on the plane, the flight attendant just came back and said, "Sir, we really need you to leave now." Felt awful. I just sat in the waiting area for about an hour before I went to get my rental car. It's kind of weird, motion sickness, because you would think that once the motion stops, that the sickness would stop too, but it doesn't work like that.
No, I get it if I ride in the back seat of a car, Jim. I know exactly how you feel. I get car sick very easily if I'm not in the front seat, and it lingers with you for a bit.
You know what they say about people like that, Bob? Because I'm the same way. You're a control freak.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, because, and that's the way I am. I have to drive. If somebody else is driving, like, I'm expecting certain kind of moves and things like that that don't happen, and that kind of screws up your equilibrium. And I'm with you on that. I can't. I'm not good. I'm not a good passenger.
Yeah, backseat is a killer. And if somebody asked me to read anything, if somebody were to hand me a, hey, what's the address? Can you read this? I'm like, nope. It's because as soon as I look down at that paper or that map or whatever, I immediately start getting nauseous.
Yeah, the only exception for Dave is when I drive, because he knows how smooth it's going to be.
That's what I've heard. That's what I've heard about you, Jim.
That's right.
Driving skills unlike any other.
One time I passed Jim on the bridge, and I looked over, because he always eats when he drives. I don't know if people know this. And it's not like he's got like a bag of chips or something. He'll have like a salad bowl and a fork. You know, it's and
who
one
doesn't,
time I went
who doesn't eat when they drive?
It's not like it's a three-course meal, though. Like you have a beef jerky or, you know, a Slim Jim or something. You've got like a full-on plate with knives and forks. And
he's got
spoons.
Cutlery there.
It's true. I do.
Oh, Jim. Plus, he can't see very well, apparently. That's not a good combo.
At night.
Oh, God. Yikes. All right. What else did we learn, DJ?
Well, I learned that I don't think I really want to ride with Jim. I don't know. That's scary.
Yeah, especially at night with his salad bowl and no glasses.
We learned about a secret technique that Mark Schlereth used in the NFL.
Anytime there was an interception, I learned this valuable technique. So here's my technique. I'd take off sprinting like I wanted to make a tackle, and I would start leaning like I had one really short leg. You ever see the guy with a shoe, you know, that's got a big lift on it, you know, he's got one short leg? And I would start running like that and run myself off the film, and then I would just stop giving effort. Because then I would know, like, eventually, like, it looked like I was really hustling at first, and then I know kind of how the camera's following the play, and then I would just run off the field and just walk to the sideline. Because if I have to run 40 yards, somebody's going to score. Like, I'm not catching anybody. So, yeah, that's pretty much when I learned that I was no longer an athlete.
Feigning effort there. He would just slowly fade out of the camera shot.
Yeah. You know, we did an exhibition game in St. Louis in the preseason in 1989, and we were playing the Patriots. And I think they were trying to get the NFL back in St. Louis at that time because the Cardinals had left for Arizona, so it was some promotional thing. Anyway, in the preseason game, I picked off a pass. And so I had to kind of slow down to put a move on the quarterback, and then I went down the sidelines, and an offensive guard, like Stink used to play, his name was Sean Farrell, he just took like a beeline, and he ended up tackling me at like the three-yard line. I never heard the end of that. A guard tackled me.
You've got such disdain for guards, too.
Oh, man. And, you know, and I after the next series, I went up to him when he was lined up, and I said, "You selfish bleep." And he started laughing, and, yeah. But, yeah, so that,
Dave, a guy off the street got you?
Yeah, a bum off the street, Jim. He was able to run me down. But I had to slow down to make the move on the quarterback and get down. Yeah, that's all a lot of excuses. All anybody saw, it wasn't like, "Hey, great play, man. You got an interception." No, it was you got ran down by an offensive lineman.
Oh, man. What did we learn anything else, DJ?
We did not learn anything else today.
All right, there you go. Big thanks to John Clayton and Mark Schlereth. Really good stuff out of him. If you missed any of today's show, just head to the podcast page at 710sports.com and click that podcast button, then click on our picture, and it's right there each and every day. We'll be back tomorrow right here with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Oh, shut up. What are you complaining about?